pull it up as hard as he could, and the back end scraped the trees. I looked over at Bev Shea, and he was just sitting there. He's never afraid of anything. Nothing ever bothers him. No nervousness at all. The trip did not quiet all Graham's misgivings. In his first encounter with reporters, he confessed that he continued to view the war as complicated, confusing, and frustrating, adding that, "I leave with more pessimism about an early end of the war than when I arrived. How can we have peace? I don't know. I don't have any answers. I had hoped there would be some formula, but I don't see it. I don't know how it could end." Perhaps because he or someone else had found this assessment too downbeat, Graham gave the Associated Press a more positive statement the following day. "The stakes are much higher in Vietnam than anybody realizes," he said, "especially for the Western world. Every American can be proud of the men in uniform who are representing our nation on that far-flung battlefront. They are paying a great price for the victory they are almost certainly winning there." And the following day, as part of a greeting relayed from servicemen to their families, he reported that he had found the troops to be extremely religious, manifesting both high morale and high morals. In late January, Graham and Cardinal Spellman, who had also made a Christmas visit to Vietnam, came to the White House to report to the President and Secretary of State Dean Rusk. According to Joseph Califano, who apparently sat in on the meeting, both clerics stressed the incredibly high morale of the troops. Graham recalled, however, that this news did not completely mollify the President, who pressed them for some insight. "Now, what do you think?" "We can't go on with this thing. The American people are not going to take it. We've got to get out of it. How do we do it?" Spellman was decidedly hawkish and favored an all-out military push. Graham claims he begged off from giving any political or military advice, but did agree that the American people are getting restless over this thing. In his conversations with the press after this meeting, he again reminded reporters that Johnson had not started the war, but had inherited it from Kennedy, and that while he would make no judgments as to whether it had been proper for America to make a commitment to South Vietnam, he felt there was an obligation to see it through to a satisfactory conclusion. Because he was out of the country during most of 1967, Graham found it relatively easy to steer clear of the explosive controversies surrounding Vietnam, though he was interrupted by protesters in London the night he preached on the cause of war, which he had identified as lust, and reporters usually tried to elicit some statement from him whenever he held a press conference. In the few public statements he did make, he typically maintained a slight pro-administration bias, and after Martin Luther King began to speak out against the war, interpreting it as another injustice wrought by a sinful system, Graham scolded him for what he regarded as an affront to the thousands of loyal Negro troops who were in Vietnam. However Graham perceived his own stance, the White House considered him a valuable ally. When a Gallup poll revealed widespread public opposition to the draft lottery, on the grounds that lotteries are associated with gambling, and that many felt it isn't right to gamble with lives, Johnson aides recommended substituting equal service for lottery, and suggested that the President ask friendly religious leaders to speak out on the misconception, especially Billy Graham. Later in the year, after most Western media outlets charged South Vietnam officials with wholesale rigging of what had been touted as free elections, Graham preached a radio sermon in which he used his familiar tactic of downplaying the seriousness of an offense and deflecting blame by pointing to a wider range of offenders. It would have been naive, he asserted, to expect the elections to be entirely fair and above board. But wasn't it remarkable that these courageous people were even trying to have elections? After all, Britain held no elections during World War II. It was also likely, he thought, that some journalists were being unfair. Many of the reporters are hostile and will report the slightest rumor and build headline-catching stories out of nothing. Besides, he reminded his listeners, there are many areas in America where shenanigans go on election day. Whatever you think of the merit of the war, I believe we should give the Vietnamese the same benefit of the doubt that we give ourselves. Some doubtless found, even in such oblique remarks, a sign that Graham's ties to the White House had short-circuited his critical acumen. but he insisted he had not been compromised. After George Romney's notorious reference to having been brainwashed by American military leaders during a visit to Vietnam, Graham observed, "I underwent the same briefings as Mr. Romney, and I wasn't brainwashed. I even lived with General Westmoreland for a time. All the men were trying to do was give us the facts. I didn't feel like they were trying to sell me a bill of goods." Illness kept Graham from returning to Vietnam for Christmas 1967, and he made even fewer public statements on the war during 1968 than in previous years. He recommended, however, that the president and his administration must decide, and quickly, whether to take whatever steps might be necessary to follow through on their commitment, or admit that America had failed in that commitment and pull out. The first time, apparently, that he considered a conclusion other than military victory or negotiated peace. Despite this growing ambivalence over the war, in a patriotic burst that must have given young Franklin Graham something to think about, he declared, "I hope my son, who is nearing draft age, will gladly go and be willing to give his life." As troubling as the war was, Graham seemed fully as disturbed by the protests and riots at home, predicting that terrorism and guerrilla warfare would soon engulf the nation. Indeed, he did not see how the American dream could survive without a drastic shift in direction, and thought it likely that in less than 10 years there will be internal chaos and a political tyranny in the form of some sort of left-wing or right-wing dictatorship, even if there is no war. Other observations were less Armageddon-like in tone, but carried echoes of some off-the-mark statements he made during the early years of his ministry. In a warm endorsement of the muscular Christianity espoused by the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, he implied that the disruptive war protest movement could have been avoided if America's youth gave more attention to sports. "I think athletics turned the great energy of young people in the right direction," he said. "People who are carrying Viet Cong flags around the country are not athletes. If our people would spend more time in gymnasiums and on playing fields, we'd be a better nation." He also minimized the dangers and horrors of the war by making the statistically spurious and astonishingly blithe comment, "We say that the slaughter in Vietnam has been terrible, but we lose more people in 1 month on the highways of America than the total Vietnam War has cost us. So it's far safer to be fighting in Vietnam than driving on the highways." Graham returned to Vietnam at Christmas, this time at the importunate invitation of General Creighton Abrams, Jr., who replaced Westmoreland. Perhaps hoping to gain some leverage with a Congress that consistently refused to provide the manpower and weaponry they felt they needed, the military accorded Graham full VIP treatment. He preached nearly 25 times, occasionally teaming up with Bob Hope, who flew in each day from Bangkok to entertain the troops. On Christmas Day, he hopped by helicopter to several fire posts along the Cambodian border. Whenever possible, he also visited military hospitals, taking time to talk with every patient in each unit and praying with those in intensive care. Once again, he found morale unbelievably high and assured the home folk that American soldiers know why they're fighting in Vietnam, and they believe what they're doing is right. He also perceived an improved political situation and reported to the president that the change in the Vietnam situation since I was there 2 years ago is like night and day. "I came back enthusiastically optimistic about the prospects of Vietnam becoming a strong free nation in Southeast Asia. I am certain that history is going to vindicate the American commitment if we don't lose the peace in Paris." He found the military situation equally encouraging and told reporters, "There is no question, the war is won militarily." When the Charlotte Observer received this bit of intelligence on wire service dispatch, someone in the newsroom wrote in the margins of the printout, "This statement has been made before, by lesser evangelists but greater generals." Graham's optimism regarding the end of the war was of a piece with his evergreen prediction that revival loomed just on the edge of the horizon. But it also stemmed from an aching hope that his tormented friend in the White House might find some relief from his burdens. He estimates that he spent perhaps 20 nights at the White House, at Camp David, and on the LBJ Ranch, in the Texas Hill Country, including several visits after Johnson left Washington. And his recollections indicate that Johnson was more candid with him than Nixon ever was. He marveled at Johnson's enormous capacity for work, recalling that sometimes, after they talked far into the night, Johnson would have a massage, usually asking Billy to read the Bible to him, while the masseur kneaded and pounded his ponderous frame. Then, instead of sleeping, he would go back to his bedroom and spend hours working through a great stack of papers he needed to process before morning. Graham readily acknowledged the president's rough, blustery, calculating, bullying side, but he also saw a warm and tender Lyndon Johnson, who, like himself, was concerned to do some great thing, if not for God, then for his country. He conceded that the programs of the Great Society were motivated in part by political aims and by a desire to leave a tangible personal legacy, but insisted that on a scale from 1 to 10, I'd say about 8, that it was a very deep conviction that he had, that he wanted to do something for the underprivileged and the people that were oppressed in our society, especially black people. Even after he left the White House, when no photographers were around to record and publicize his actions, Johnson showed a personal concern. "I used to think it was sort of a political thing," Graham confessed, "but I visited the ranch a number of times after he left office, and he still had that compassion. He would fill his car up with little black children and take them for rides and stop at the store and buy them candy and pick them up in his arms. He just had this built-in compassion for them. This had no political motivation whatsoever. He also had a great feeling for the Hispanic people. His compassion for the poor and the blacks was a very real thing." When Lyndon Johnson announced on March 31, 1968, that in the interest of national unity, he would not seek re-election, Billy Graham was one of the few Americans not surprised. Nearly a year earlier, before public confidence in his handling of the war dipped to abysmal levels, before Bobby Kennedy revealed his intention to seek the Democratic nomination, Johnson confided to Graham that he did not expect to run for a second term. That decision, Graham has contended, stemmed less from weariness with the struggle than from fears about his health. "My people don't live too long," Johnson had said. "My father died when he was about my age. I don't think I could live out another term, and I don't want the country to have to deal with that." Such fears were not rare for Johnson, according to Graham. "He thought a great deal about death, and he talked to me about it several times." As part of these conversations, Graham quite naturally took the opportunity to speak to the president about the state of his soul. "I had a number of quiet, private talks with him about his relationship with the Lord," the always-on-duty evangelist recalled. "One of them was not long before he died. We were sitting in his convertible Lincoln, where he'd been chasing some of the deer right across the fields. We were stopped, looking out, and the sun was sinking. We had a very emotional time, because I just told him straight out that if he had any doubts about his relationship with God, that he'd better get it settled. I said, 'Mr. President,' I still called him Mr. President then. Before he became president, I called him Lyndon, 'According to what you say, you don't think you have much longer to live. You'd better be sure you're right with God and have made your peace with him.' He bowed his head over the steering wheel and said, 'Billy, would you pray for me?' I said, 'Yes, sir,' and I did. He was very reflective after that. We must have sat there for another hour, hardly talking at all, just looking at the sunset." Later, during that same visit, Johnson told Graham that he wanted him to preach at his funeral and gave him the choice of presiding over a memorial service in Washington or the burial at the ranch. Graham said he felt more comfortable at the ranch, which seemed to please the president. He led the preacher over to a small grave plot and said, "I want to be buried right here. My father's grave is right there. My mother's right there." Then he stopped and looked Graham in the eye. "Billy, will I ever see my mother and father again?" Graham provided him with the promise that gives evangelical faith its greatest power. "Well, Mr. President, if you're a Christian and they were Christians, then someday you'll have a great homecoming." Johnson pulled out a handkerchief and began brushing tears from his eyes. Then he decided that others needed to hear what he had just heard. Returning to discussion of the funeral, he said, "Obviously, there'll be members of the press here. I don't know how many, but maybe they'll come from around the world. Billy, I want you to look in those cameras and just tell them what Christianity is all about. Tell them how they can be sure they can go to heaven. I want you to preach the gospel." He paused. "But somewhere in there, you tell them a few things I did for this country." As he recalled this memory, Graham smiled with obvious affection for a flawed but titanic figure who had also been his friend. His voice trailing off as he looked into the distance, perhaps catching an afterimage of a hill country sunset, he summed up Lyndon Johnson with a head-shaking understatement. He was quite a combination. Chapter 22. Nixon Revived. As fond as he was of Lyndon Johnson, 8 years of Democratic occupancy of the White House did little to shake Billy Graham's conviction that America still needed his old friend Richard Nixon. Pneumonia prevented Graham from going to Vietnam during the Christmas holidays in 1967, but when Nixon invited him to spend a few days in Florida to help him reach a decision about making another try for the presidency, Graham rose from his sickbed and took a private plane to Key Biscayne, declaring bravely that there are times when some things are more important than health. The two men spent several days together, talking, watching football games, going for long walks on the beach, studying the Bible and praying, and of course, speculating about whether Nixon would have a chance at the Republican nomination. And if he got it, whether he could defeat Lyndon Johnson, who he assumed would seek re-election. Because of his loyalty to Johnson, and perhaps because he did not want Nixon to risk another crushing disappointment, Graham withheld his counsel. Finally, near the end of their visit, Nixon said, "You still haven't told me what I ought to do." Billy told him all he needed to hear. "Well, if you don't, you'll worry for the rest of your life whether you should have, won't you?" That was enough for both of them. Nixon would report on several later occasions that Graham had been more responsible than anyone else for his decision to run. And Billy began immediately to resume knitting the fabric of fellowship that would very nearly become a pall on his ministry. When the press learned of his visit and asked if he would like to see Richard Nixon on the Republican ticket in 1968, he conceded that, "I would go that far." Mindful of his ties to the incumbent, he added that, "I would not say who I would vote for as president, but I would say he is the most experienced Republican for the type of conflict we have today." He stressed that he was a registered Democrat, but reserved the right to be flexible. "I vote independently," he said, "and I usually split. I vote for the man and not the party." The following spring was routine for Graham, but wrenching for America. With the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, Johnson's decision not to run again, an increase in campus disturbances, and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. At the time of King's death, Graham was in an Australian crusade, part of which had to be rescheduled for 1969 because of yet another bout of illness, this time a serious lung problem. Graham interpreted the assassination as further evidence that America was unraveling, calling it dramatic indication that we have tens of thousands of mentally deranged people in America. In some respects, it has become an anarchy. Unable to return home for the funeral, he sent telegrams and flowers and gave the press a muted tribute to King. "Many people who have not agreed with Dr. King can admire him for his nonviolent policies, and in the eyes of the world, he has become one of the greatest Americans." King's death did not lead Graham to believe he needed to take more daring action. A few weeks after the assassination, Howard Jones and Ralph Bell sent him a long letter in which they recalled that riots had erupted in 125 cities after King's death, and that other trouble could be expected during the coming summer. They suggested that he and BGA had an unparalleled opportunity to step into the gap and provide responsible leadership on the racial issues. Specifically, they urged him to commission a film aimed at both blacks and whites that would enable him to use his enormous influence to address burning issues in a bold and forthright way. Perhaps to avoid a confrontation that might have resulted in long-term strain, Graham chose not to respond directly. Instead, he directed an aide to assure Jones and Bell that he felt his long-standing practice of integrated crusades and his increased use of black musicians, black clergy, and black celebrities were having a more beneficial effect than anything else he could do. A few weeks after that, at Bobby Kennedy's funeral, he stood beside Ralph Abernathy, who was aggressively defining himself as King's legitimate successor, and thought to himself, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could see Dr. King's dream come true? But he moved no closer to using, or even fully approving, King's tactics of prophetic confrontation and challenge of the establishment. By late spring, it seemed increasingly likely that Nixon would capture the Republican nomination. Before President Johnson withdrew from the campaign, Graham insisted he was studiously trying to avoid political involvement this year. With Johnson out, however, and with the country going through its greatest crisis since the Civil War, he acknowledged that many people who just don't know how to cast their vote might accept what I have to say. Did that mean he might endorse a specific candidate? I might find I will, he allowed. I do believe I could influence a great number of people. At a Portland crusade in May, he introduced Julie and Tricia Nixon to the assembly, noting that there is no American I admire more than Richard Nixon. And from that point until the election in November, he dropped so many favorable statements about Nixon that none but a dunce could have mistaken his intentions. Certainly Democrats understood. A Johnson aide reported to the president that several senators and other leading Democrats were disturbed at Billy Graham's intention to support Richard Nixon. Recalling that the evangelist had been talked out of an open endorsement in 1960, the aide added, I know and understand and approve the rules you're operating under, but there must be some way or suggestion you can make on how to prevent Billy Graham from doing this. A handwritten note on the memo indicates the president has no influence. Another note from Johnson himself, and partly illegible, reads, Call him. I'm just his friend. I can't control him. National Council of Churches executive Don Potter, a staunch Graham admirer since the 1957 New York Crusade, observed that even without explicitly endorsing Nixon, Graham could play a significant role in an election. Billy has tremendous power, he noted, almost frightening power. I think he uses this with a degree of discretion, but such power in a single individual. I say it's frightening, because I think that Billy's presence in terms of Nixon's election has a real influence. And when he sits by a prospective candidate, even though he tries to be in every way a friend of all presidents and kings, he has to guard this very carefully. Because he does have the power of a person who is a symbol to millions of persons who watch his every move, and even a casual gesture becomes a significant signal. I think he is partially aware of the truth of this, and therefore his influence is quite tremendous. At the Republican convention in Miami in August, Graham, at Nixon's request, led the closing prayer after the nominee made his acceptance speech. As the evangelist offered congratulations and said his goodbyes, Nixon caught him by the arm and offered him a delicious perk, a chance to sit in on the selection of his running mate. You'll be interested in this, he said. It's part of history. Back in a hotel suite, Graham stood at the edge of a circle of 20 or so Nixon insiders and prominent Republican leaders, listening with fascination as they discussed possibilities. Deep into the night, and without warning, Nixon turned to him and said, Billy, what do you think? Graham was taken aback, afraid I was putting myself in a political thing I didn't want to get into, but unable to pass up a chance to offer his opinion. I would prefer Oregon Senator Mark Hatfield, he said. First of all, he's a great Christian leader. He's almost a clergyman. He's been an educator and has taken a more liberal stand on most issues than you, and I think the ticket needs that kind of a balance. Whatever Nixon thought of Graham's advice, Hatfield's well-known opposition to American policy in Southeast Asia and his support of Arab interests in the Middle East made him unacceptable to others in the room. Perhaps sensing he had already said too much, Graham decided it was time to head back to his hotel in Key Biscayne. The next morning, Nixon called Graham to tell him he had decided on Maryland Governor Spiro Agnew. Graham was utterly surprised. I'm sure Nixon didn't know him very well. I said, why did you choose him? He gave me his answers, which I don't want to reveal. And I said, well, I hope he loves the Lord and will be a Christian vice president. And he said, well, you listen at about 12 o'clock and you'll hear the announcement. Then about 10 or 11, his communications director called me and said, Billy, Dick wanted me to call you and tell you it's still up in the air. It's between Agnew and Hatfield. So I listened at 12 o'clock, and of course it was Agnew. That night I went to the convention as the guest of Senator Frank Carlson, a very close friend of mine. We sat there and you could just feel a pall over the convention. I said, if my assessment's right, this is not a popular choice. And he said, you're right. We don't know him. I was called to platform to lead a prayer that night, and I met Agnew for the first time. I never saw him after the campaign, I think, except at the inauguration, and maybe once at the White House at a religious service. I never knew him at all. The night he resigned, I called him on the phone and told him I'd be praying for him, whatever the future held, because that's the time I think a minister has some input spiritually. That's the only contact I ever had with Mr. Agnew. The Democrat selection of Hubert Humphrey, another old friend, kept some check on Graham's expressions of enthusiasm for Nixon, but his preference was transparent. At a September crusade in Pittsburgh, he read a telegram of greeting from Humphrey, but he invited Nixon to take a prominent seat in the VIP section, where the television cameras could easily find him, and he lauded him from the platform, citing his generosity, his tremendous constraint of temper, and his integrity in counting his golf score, and calling their friendship one of the most cherished I have had with anyone. Nixon described the occasion as one of the most moving religious experiences of my life. The telecast of that particular service, broadcast just before the election, was added to Graham's TV schedule at the last minute because of the urgency of the hour. A few days after his crusade appearance, Nixon made a well-announced and thoroughly photographed call on Morrow Graham in Charlotte, displaying his ease and charm by observing three times that he felt obligated to visit Billy's mother, since Billy had preached at his own mother's funeral a few months earlier. 3 weeks later, Julie Nixon turned up in Montreat for a visit at the Graham home, furnishing Billy with another opportunity to note that he was contemplating an endorsement, but was not quite ready to give one at that point. Without explaining what constituted the difference between an official endorsement and a clear and frequent statement of preference. Sometimes Graham's support came disguised as his own assessment of the political climate, as when he professed to discern a rightward trend among a big segment of the population, a segment whose members did not carry placards or demonstrate or take what they wanted by violence, but who were nevertheless out there and ready to act. A great unheard-from group, who were likely to be heard from loudly at the polls. No one sensitive to campaign rhetoric would likely have missed the similarity between this group, presumably people Billy Graham had seen in his own audiences, and the silent majority the Republicans were courting so assiduously. At other times, Graham presented his non-endorsement as if he were no more than a neutral friend of the court. When Democrats trotted out their old reliable slurs on Nixon's basic character, Graham declared that his friend has a great sense of moral integrity. I've never seen any indication of or agreed with the label that his enemies had given him of Tricky Dick. In the years I've known him, he's never given any indication of being tricky. He acknowledged that Nixon was reticent about speaking of his religious life, but declared he knew him to be a devout person and a man of high principles, with a profound philosophy of government, and characterized him as having the qualities to make an American Churchill in time of national crisis. After offering yet another such defense, he added, "While I do not intend to publicly endorse any political candidate, as some clergymen are doing, I maintain the right to help put the record straight when a friend is smeared." 2 decades later, Graham insisted that while Nixon's aides may have wanted to exploit their friendship, Nixon tried to protect him from possible backlash. "It seems to me, as I look back," he said, "that he wanted to guard me. I was in Atlanta when he was giving a speech, and he said, 'Don't come, it'll be too political.' But Ruth and I wanted to go, so we went and sat in the back so nobody would see us. His aides did see us, and we rode back to the hotel with him. I remember that somebody had asked him what he intended to do about the fire ant problem if he were elected president. He said, "I'll tell you this. When we get to the White House, we're going to deal with them. We're going to handle that." We teased him about that in the car. That was the only time I ever went to one of his campaign meetings. Graham apparently overlooked his much publicized presence in a studio audience of one of the carefully managed question and answer shows Nixon used during the campaign. On a later show, the moderator asked the candidate if it was true that evangelist Billy Graham was supporting him. Nixon replied that he felt safe in reporting that it was true. A few days later, Graham himself provided confirmation. In an interview published 4 days before the election, he revealed that he had already cast his absentee vote for Richard Nixon. Nixon campaign operative Harry Dent freely admitted he had exploited that bit of good news in television ads that ran right down to the wire on the following Tuesday. Less readily acknowledged was that, according to some sources, the new ads had been in production for at least 3 weeks before Graham made his well-timed announcement. Nixon invited Graham to watch the election returns with him in New York, but Billy demurred. He did, however, agree to stay at a nearby hotel to be available to pray with him if he lost the election. About 9 the next morning, when it appeared certain that Nixon had edged Humphrey by approximately 500,000 votes, B.B. Rebozo called to say that Dick wants you to come over and have prayer with the family. It was hardly the consolation in defeat he had been prepared to offer, but it was close enough. And he and T.W. Wilson hustled over to the President-elect's hotel suite, where Rebozo ushered him in to see the Nixons and their two daughters. After a few minutes of congratulations and election talk, Nixon said, "Billy, I want you to lead us in prayer. We want to rededicate our lives." Graham recalled that we all held hands and I led prayer. And then he went straight off to meet the press. He always had that spiritual side to him. It was always coming out. Graham remained impressed by the irrepressible outcroppings of Nixon's spirituality, though he did feel it needed some channeling and pointing up on occasion. As he recalled, Nixon wanted him to be the only clergyman to pray at the inauguration, but I told him, "You cannot leave the Jewish people out. You cannot leave out the Catholics and the Orthodox." But he said, "No, I want you, and I want you to take 10 minutes. I told him, "No, sir, I can't do that." Finally, someone did persuade him that he had to have all the major religious groups, but I think I did take 3 or 4 minutes, which time called Billy Graham's mini-inaugural address. In the process of that extended prayer, which Christian Century characterized as a raucous harangue that made Nixon's inaugural speech seem simple and winsome by comparison, Graham thanked God that thou hast permitted Richard Nixon to lead us at this momentous hour of history, and expressed confidence that America was headed toward the dawning of a new day. One may doubt that God arranged Nixon's victory over Hubert Humphrey, especially since the margin of his triumph, less than 1%, was not as impressive as, for example, that of the Israelites over the Amalekites. But Richard Nixon's term in office unquestionably initiated a new era for civil religion, that blend of religious and political culture that has potential to both call a nation to acknowledge and honor its transcendent ideals and to delude it into thinking it has already done so. Every president in American history had invoked the name and blessing of God during his inauguration address, and many, including Billy Graham's friends Dwight Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson, had made some notable public display of their putative piety. But none ever made such a conscious, calculating use of religion as a political instrument as did Richard Nixon. Like other presidents before him, Nixon appeared at prayer breakfasts and made the standard salutes in heaven's direction. But the keystone of his effort to present himself as a man deeply concerned with religion and religious values was the White House church service, which he initiated on the first Sunday after his inauguration, with Billy Graham as the preacher. Other presidents had held religious services in the White House. Indeed, Lyndon Johnson had invited the cabinet, leading staff members, and some of his personal friends to a service in the White House on the Sunday immediately following John Kennedy's funeral. And Billy Graham was the speaker on that occasion as well. But none before Nixon had ever sponsored a regular schedule of Sunday services. Throughout Nixon's presidency, an uncommon amount of his staff's time and attention went into the White House Sunday services. Surely some genuine spiritual benefit was obtained by the participants, by the guests, perhaps even by the president himself. And Billy Graham still maintained, 15 years after the last amen, that they were basically beneficial, though he recognized that the negative publicity they drew in some quarters had backfired on the president. "I thought it was a good idea at the time," he said, "and in hindsight, I still think it was a good idea. It was better than not going to church at all, and the president was worried about security and the commotion it would cause if he went to a regular church." Some people thought it was practicing civil religion. Mark Hatfield had that view, but I never thought of it in those terms. I just thought it was a great idea that the president of the United States would have services in the White House. I don't think there was any political connotation. There might have been, but I think Nixon was being very sincere. He wanted to set an example for the whole country. Time magazine asserted that after the first 3 months of the Nixon presidency, Billy Graham's spirituality pervades the White House. But documents from the Nixon archives make it clear that his was not the only spirit roaming the halls of the National Mansion. Early memos regarding the Sunday services dealt with format, frequency, possible speakers and musical groups, and denominational representation. The staff sought Graham's advice on these matters, and he submitted a long list of possible speakers, stuffing it with such evangelical colleagues as Stephen Olford, Harold Lincell, Leighton Ford, and Nelson Bell, but also taking care to include old friends like Gerald Kennedy, several prominent black ministers, Roman Catholic Archbishop H.E. Cardinale, and spokesmen from both the National Council and World Council of Churches. Within a short time, however, the staff was clearly less interested in setting the tone for the Republic than in forging a tool for Republicans. An early action memo to Charles Colson instructed him to get moving on the president's request that you develop a list of rich people with strong religious interest to be invited to the White House church services. Colson and his colleagues apparently performed quite admirably. The guest list for a subsequent service included the presidents or board chairman of AT&T, General Electric, General Motors, Chrysler, Goodyear Tire and Rubber, Westinghouse, PepsiCo, Bechtel, Boise Cascade, Republic Steel, Federated Department Stores, and Continental Can Corporation. Not every boatload of pilgrims to the White House packed such corporate weight, but none was composed of seekers plucked randomly from the shore. One memo allocating a quota of invitees to various personnel, cabinet members, Charles Colson, and Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods, got approximately 50 slots each. Pat Nixon and Harry Dent received 10 apiece. POW wives were allotted 6 seats, specifically recommended that non-VIPs be limited to no more than 25% of the congregation. In another memo, Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, noted that we are now covering the members of the regulatory agencies, pointing out that while that was not objectionable in itself, all of our assistant secretaries and other presidential appointees should be covered first. It isn't going to do us one bit of good to have a member of a regulatory agency at the church service or any other function. If they are to be invited, please limit the invitations to the chairman or an appointee we are working on for a specific purpose. As might be expected for such an explicitly instrumental device, every effort was made to make sure that no preacher breached protocol by pretending to be a prophet and that all reports of the services be as favorable as possible. When Billy Graham was not in the pulpit, contrary to the popular impression that he was a regular performer, he preached at only 4 White House services in the 6 years they were held, though he did sometimes show up on other occasions to lead prayer and confer a blessing simply by being present. The staff tried to be sure their pastor for the day was a conservative, a Nixon backer, and in touch with a major constituency. When Cincinnati Archbishop Joseph Bernardin was invited to participate in a service shortly before St. Patrick's Day, a memo explained that Bernardin was selected because he is the most prominent Catholic of Irish extraction and a strong supporter of the president. We have verified this. At times, safe men were hard to find. When Harry Dent submitted a list of some good conservative Protestant Southern Baptists, he felt moved to add, "They are the only good conservative Protestant ministers." Sometimes even conservatives were hard to trust. Elton Trueblood, theologically conservative but dovish in sentiment and independent in character, was given two handwritten notes prior to entering the pulpit, both stressing that he was not to raise any political issues in his sermon. The staff recognized, of course, that an invitation to speak at the White House could enhance a preacher's reputation and was willing to confer that blessing in return for expected political favors. In June 1970, after Nixon raised Baptist hackles by appointing Henry Cabot Lodge as his unofficial emissary to the Vatican, Graham suggested that inviting Carl Bates, president of the Southern Baptist Convention, might offset some of the criticism Nixon was receiving. Then a few months before the annual meeting of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1971, he recommended that lay preacher Fred Rhodes, who expected to seek the presidency of that 12-million-member denomination, be invited to preach. A staffer noted that Rhodes was a staunch Nixon loyalist, and that a White House invitation to speak would aid greatly in his campaign for this office. The quid pro quo was no mystery. If elected, Colson feels that Rhodes would be quite helpful to the president in 1972. Perhaps feeling Nixon's decision to create a religious sanctuary in the White House meant he was finally going to go public with the deep religious convictions Graham had been attributing to him for 15 years. Billy tried to edge him a bit closer to the altar to get the president to own up to the piety the preacher felt certain was present. Before Nixon's first appearance at the presidential prayer breakfast, sponsored not by the president, but by the International Christian Leadership Organization, Graham recommended that the president's remarks probably should be very low-key and appear to be impromptu. It would also be good, he thought, if the president would talk about his religious childhood and the impact of religious people on his life, mainly Sunday school teachers, the pastor of the Whittier Church where he attended as a child, and other people such as this. Graham figured, no doubt, that such a reminiscence would both appeal to the assemblage and reopen the springs of Nixon's religious sentiments. The evangelist told any who would listen that no one who saw Nixon perform on such occasions could fail to be impressed, but he privately pressed for more, urging Nixon in the fall of 1969 to make a statement similar to the one Lincoln gave before the end of the Civil War, issuing an anguished call to prayer. At about the same time, he sent along a plan suggested to him by Jane Pickens Langley, the wife of William C. Langley, former president of the New York Stock Exchange, in which she suggested that at noon each day, everything, including television and radio, could be stopped for 2 minutes of silent prayer with a definite subject suggested. With a siren serving as a call to prayer, Ms. Langley felt virtually certain that very few people in this country would fail to comply, even if only out of superstition. It should be an act of patriotism, in which everyone wants voluntarily to participate, and if it is presented correctly, it can become that. To this singularly blatant suggestion that the nation adopt a new ritual for its burgeoning civil religion, Graham appended a simple note. "I personally think she has a point." Nixon chose not to push for a daily prayer break, but he clearly valued most of Graham's efforts on behalf of his administration's religious program. He was dependently effusive over his White House sermons and treated his appearances as more special than those of other preachers. On one occasion, he not only invited 80-year-old Morrow Graham and Nelson Bell to attend the service at which Billy was preaching, but gave Graham the right to invite as many as 30 additional guests, a singular allocation of scarce political resources. Nixon also appreciated the fact that when Billy Graham was preaching, he never had to worry about surprises. Graham would not say anything to embarrass him and would smooth over any rough spots that might arise. At one interfaith service at which Graham appeared on the program with Rabbi Edgar Magnin and John Cardinal Kroll, the elderly rabbi got up to speak before his time had come, thus inadvertently cutting out a second number the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was prepared to sing. He also used more than the 10 minutes or so the staff had allotted for his remarks. When his own time came to speak, Graham graciously observed that he thought it might be best to have a few moments to reflect on Rabbi Magnin's wisdom before his own sermon, and wondered if the choir might be able to grace the congregation with another offering. The choir happily complied. Graham cut his own prepared remark short, and the service ended on time, just as if it had been a television program. Members of the congregation may never have noticed, but Richard Nixon did, and wrote a note of gratitude for his friend's skillful handling of an awkward situation. Charles Colson, whose reputation as the most cynical of Nixon's aides, has been badly tarnished by what appears to be a thoroughly genuine religious conversion, and by subsequent years of leadership of the Prison Fellowship Ministry, believed that Nixon's interest in religion had an authentic aspect. "Sure," he admitted, "we use the prayer breakfasts and church services and all that for political ends. I was part of doing that." But Nixon was an interesting guy. There was an ambivalence about him. There were times when I thought he was genuinely spiritually seeking. The things he believed as a young man, he said he no longer believed. He didn't believe in the resurrection or in Jonah being swallowed by the whale. He believed those were symbols. But then he'd talk about Catholics and how they had a set of firm beliefs. He'd say he wished he could be a Catholic because they had a set of beliefs and were comfortable with them. You could tell he was struggling inside. That was probably his mother's influence working on him. At the same time, he was a very shrewd politician. He knew how to use religious people to maximum advantage. He used to write orders on giving aid to religious schools, or he'd take Cardinal Kroll out on the Sequoia, the presidential yacht. That was aimed at winning the Catholic vote. But that's what politicians do. Billy Graham saw less of the calculating Nixon and recognized that many observers saw little or nothing of the pious Nixon. But he too insisted that his friend never quite shed the religious impulses that had sent him and his brother striding down the aisle at evangelist Paul Rader's tent meeting in Los Angeles years before. "There's a very deep religious side to Richard Nixon that never came out," he insisted. "He's a Quaker, and Quakers don't believe in expressing their religion much, but he would talk about it to me privately. I made a deal with him. I said, 'I will not keep any notes or diary on my relationship with you because you deserve privacy. You deserve to have some people around you whom you know are not going to divulge conversations, and especially a clergyman. I want you to have somebody that you can talk to in confidence.' I think he felt that with me and with Ruth. He told us some things that I am sure he would never want anyone to know. He would take off his shoes and talk by the hour." The closeness between the two men extended well beyond the confessional, and each felt at ease trading favors with the other. Sometimes the favors were minor, as when someone on the White House staff persuaded Duke Ellington to include vocalist Jimmy MacDonald, who had recently left Graham's crusade team, in a concert of sacred music the famed bandleader was presenting on the West Coast. On another occasion, after spending a weekend at Lyndon Johnson's ranch in Texas, Graham tactfully conveyed word that the former president would greatly appreciate an invitation to come to Cape Kennedy to watch the launching of the rocket that would send Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins to the moon. The request was promptly granted, with Nixon himself making the call to his predecessor. Other exchanges were more substantial. When it appeared that perhaps as many as 4,000 unordained but full-time Christian workers, including a sizable contingent from Bill Bright's Campus Crusade for Christ movement, were about to be drafted in 1969, Graham placed an urgent call to the White House, contending that they should receive the same exemption granted to ordained ministers. Previously, most local draft boards had routinely granted the exemption. When they had not, the National Selective Service System Appeal Board had upheld the right of such workers for the ministerial exemption. As the war wore on, however, many local draft boards tightened up, and the appeal board began to turn down requests to exempt Campus Crusade workers on the grounds that they were not actually ministers. In a memo to Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, Dwight Chapin reported that Dr. Graham states that, on the President's Review Board, there are one or two gentlemen who are antagonistic toward the work done by these Christian leaders. Needless to say, Graham is very anxious to have someone look into this matter and to see that the policy of exempting these full-time Christian leaders is carried through. The White House obviously considered this as more than a minor annoyance, to be finessed as gracefully as possible. Several staffers got involved in seeking a resolution, and one memo noted that since the board serves at the pleasure of the president, the most quiet and expeditious method of obtaining a review of this matter would be to replace at least some of its members. Graham professed not to recall this episode, but the matter of deferring Billy Graham's people was on the White House agenda for at least 2 months, and a talking paper for a telephone conversation with the evangelist directed that he be told there was little danger of a wholesale draft of these ministers. Predictably, Graham's friendship with Nixon drew heavy fire from several quarters. Liberal clergymen and others opposed to the war in Vietnam regularly condemned the evangelist for his failure to behave as a prophet, a stance that, in their opinion, required him to use whatever influence he possessed to persuade Nixon to refrain from bombing and to bring the war to a swift end, even at the price of conceding a defeat in American policy, if not in actual combat. Will Campbell, an iconoclastic Southern preacher whose efforts to minister to both the victims and perpetrators of racial hatred and whose calls for peace in Vietnam had won him status as a true prophet, branded Graham a false court prophet who tells Nixon and the Pentagon what they want to hear. Nicholas von Hoffman unleashed such a stinging assault on Graham that Herb Klein felt moved to register a complaint with the editor of the Washington Post. Gary Wills called the friendship between the two men an alliance of moral dwarfs, and I.F. Stone called the clergyman Nixon's smoother Rasputin. And so it went. In part, the criticism stemmed from the perception that Graham had an undiscriminating sense of sin, that because he regarded all sins as manifestations of the same fallen nature, and all humans as equally sinful, though perhaps redeemed. He found it difficult to distinguish between, for example, pornography and saturation bombing of civilians. His critics also resented his decided preference for obedience to authority. Virtually any authority that did not expressly forbid worship of God or compel worship of some other being, and his underlying assumption that those in power, particularly in the United States, were more likely to be right than wrong. Finally, they charged him with abdicating responsibility for improving the world by preaching that such problems as racial injustice, poverty, and war would never be solved until Jesus returned to inaugurate the millennium. None of the charges was groundless. Since the end of the benevolent empire created by Charles Finney and his contemporaries before the Civil War, evangelicals had concentrated on problems of individual behavior and character, rather than on the shortcomings of corporate bodies. In Moral Man and Immoral Society, Reinhold Niebuhr brilliantly described how men of good character and impeccable personal morals could and did participate in business, government, and other large-scale institutions that were engaged in unjust, sinful, exceedingly destructive behavior, without any clear sense of incongruity or paradox. Evangelicals, with Billy Graham as a classic example, seem never to have grasped Niebuhr's point. To Graham, structures were immoral because they were made up of immoral individuals. If these individuals could be redeemed, then the structures would automatically right themselves and begin to behave in a Christian manner. For that reason, calling for repentance on the part of small-time sinners, the bartender who sells beer to minors, the income tax chiseler, the college grad whose diploma is won by cribbing rather than cramming, seemed to Graham to be as important a part of the answer to corruption as passing laws to curb wholesale abuses by corporations and the politicians. It was also easy, at a time when millions of Americans were challenging all forms of authority, to find support for the view that despite an Arenic spirit and ostensible commitment to individualism, Billy Graham was an authoritarian personality. He had said, "I once asked an Army officer which he would rather have on the field of battle, courage or obedience. He flashed right back, obedience." God would rather have your obedience than anything else. He repeatedly asserted that young people had rallied to Hitler and Mussolini and various communist leaders because they wanted a master to be the center of their lives. And he believed that nothing, not racism, not a divisive war in Southeast Asia, was likely to be so dangerous to the security of the nation and so odious in the eyes of God as angry protests in the street and rebellious assault on the system by student radicals. As for clergymen who led protests against the war, in an address before the Southern Baptist Convention, he said, "Where many of these men get the reverend in front of their names, I do not know. Certainly they don't get it from God." A man who openly challenged the standing order, he seemed to be saying, could not be a man of God. "It is interesting to me," he observed, "that God does not tolerate disorder. He laid down precise laws in the physical, chemical, and electrical world." Since God did not tolerate disorder, Graham saw little reason for his appointed representatives to do so either. He told a gathering of Protestant policemen in New York City that they were agents of God with a tremendous responsibility at this hour of revolution and anarchy and rebellion against all authority that is sweeping across our nation. And he lamented that the Supreme Court, in trying to protect freedom, is giving the nation dangerous license. He huddled with J. Edgar Hoover to receive a report on radical students and declared a few days later that there is a small, highly organized group of radicals who were determined to destroy what they call the system and were very dangerous to the security of our nation. In an interview on NBC television, he revealed that he had information that approximately 100 terrorist groups would soon begin a campaign to destroy established order in the nation. With regard to the third objection his critics raised, Graham always acknowledged that he saw no lasting solution to most of the world's problems, short of the Second Coming. Without question, this conviction seriously weakened his and other evangelicals' commitment to movements dedicated to major social change. But he did not invoke this belief as a means of escaping responsibility. He invoked it because he believed it was true, because he believed the Bible taught it. Even so, his views on the two great social issues of the decade, race and Vietnam, were neither as individualistic nor as patently acquiescent to governmental authority as his critics charged. On the question of race, Graham stuck to his long-standing policy of insisting on integrated crusades, urging brotherhood and understanding, and warning that demonstrations and protests were likely to prove futile and counterproductive. In the summer of 1969, when Graham returned to Madison Square Garden for a 10-day crusade, civil rights activist James Forman was presenting his Black Manifesto to white churches and synagogues, demanding they pay $500 million in reparations to Black Americans. When asked at a pre-crusade news conference if he expected Forman to present his demands at the Garden, Graham replied dryly that, "I don't think we're going to have any outside speakers. I'm going to do the preaching. If he were to come, we would welcome him with a big smile and hope he enjoyed the service." Perhaps sensing he would never get past the Garden's security force, or if he did, that he would not be able to work the guilt of Graham's congregation as successfully as that of, say, New York's liberal Riverside Church, Forman made no attempt to interrupt the crusade services, and Graham never mentioned the Black Manifesto in his sermons. He did, however, attract more blacks to the Garden than he had in 1957. Time magazine estimated that at least a quarter of his audience on most nights was non-white. For all his distance from the main arenas of conflict, Graham's frequent references to racial injustice and his principal adherence to what he did believe made it easier for other evangelicals to take stronger stands. An important manifestation of that phenomenon came in September 1969 at the U.S. Congress on Evangelism. Though BGEA had no official role in this gathering, its leaders consciously saw themselves as extending the work of the 1966 Berlin Congress. Graham served as honorary chairman and gave a major address. The meeting was held in Minneapolis, and a book containing the speeches delivered at the gathering was edited by George Wilson and produced by BGEA's Worldwide Publications. This Congress, which attracted 5,000 delegates from 93 denominations and most states, served as a kind of springboard, enabling evangelicals to identify more boldly with social